This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Is City Watch live streaming again, WBAI.org.
Good morning. I'm Bic Hafam, co-host of City Watch, a watchdog for social, economic, political, and cultural issues in New York City. Joined this morning by co-hosts Mark Dunley and Brooke Ritchie.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our show today, we have Jarrett Murphy, who is our regular visitor and guest with us, editor-in-chief of City Limits, and he will be providing a news brief. Then Patrick Marquis, senior policy analyst for the Coalition for the Homeless. He's going to discuss their State of the Homeless 2011 report that just recently came out. It highlights a new all-time record homeless population in New York City and analyzes city data showing why the Bloomberg administration's subsidy programs that are time-limited for homeless individuals have actually contributed to record homelessness. And Patrick is going to talk with us about what they think is an outline to reduce the homeless population, especially in regards to the federal housing resources. Our next guest will be Anthony Ng. He's the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the United Neighborhood Houses, and he'll provide an update on the New York City budget, which is wrapping up maybe just a few more weeks to the end of the month. So the situation is tense. There are many, many cuts to vital services and programs on the table, and he's going to particularly be talking about the youth services programs for many of our low-income youth of color in the city. And our last guest will be Tim Casey. He's a senior staff attorney with Legal Momentum, now Legal Defense and Education Fund, to talk about their work advancing the rights of women and girls and their recent report on the situation with women in poverty and single mothers. It's called At Rope's End. So we have a great show this morning, lots of packed.
And I'll point out, right after our show, we're going to Clearwater from 11 to, I believe, 7 o'clock. So that you want to stay tuned for that as well, the Clearwater Festival up there in Groton.
Right. And before we start, Brooke, did you have a couple announcements?
Yes. So I wanted to announce that the Resilience Advocacy Project, a youth advocacy and youth development organization here in the city, is now accepting applications from young people for our peer advocacy training program. Young people ages 16 to 19 who are interested in becoming community leaders and advocates for other youth can access an application at www.resiliencelaw.org or email programs@resiliencelaw.org for more information.
So we're going to start this morning with Jarrett Murphy, editor-in-chief of City Limits. Good morning, Jarrett.
Good morning.
So, Jarrett, there's lots going on
out
there.
You've got lots to talk to us about.
Definitely. Well, you know, I think I should start with sort of the two major news things that are happening this morning. And, you know, I'm not sure what the latest developments have been in the past couple of hours, but obviously up in Albany, two huge discussions going on about extending and how to extend rent regulations, which affect, you know, at least a million units of housing in New York City, you know, which is revolving around the question, not so much of whether they're going to be extended, that seems kind of a given, but whether they'll be tweaked at all in terms of vacancy and luxury decontrol, two mechanisms that have helped to usher several thousand apartments out of the rent regulation system in the past 5 to 10 years. And the debate seems to be about, you know, whether to adjust it in a small way, which is what the landlord side seems to be willing to accept, or whether to remove those caps altogether. So that'll be a very interesting discussion. That's obviously tied to the cap on property taxes that a lot of upstate legislators want. And that's obviously going parallel with the gay marriage debate, which is a very, you know, obviously historic one that has now apparently bogged down over the issue of whether religious institutions will have the right to basically to discriminate against people who participate in gay marriages. In other words, that a Catholic church wouldn't have to marry two gay people if they didn't want to. So it's kind of funny that at this stage it's the religious institutions that are worried about their rights as opposed to the people who want to get married. But those are two, you know, obviously huge things going on in Albany that, you know, probably will be resolved in the next couple of days. But I would watch that carefully. A recommendation to anyone who is, you know, looking at their Netflix queue is, you know, this is Jared's movie reviews. There's a movie called Gideon's Trumpet, which is an old, like, 1980s, like, Hallmark film with Henry Fonda. And it's about the Gideon versus Wainwright case, which is about, you know, the right of poor people to receive the provision of legal counsel. It's a terrific movie, a great drama, and, like, a really terrific story about, you know, progress in America. And we have a story on our site this week at citylimits.org that might be charting out the next chapter in that story, and it's about immigrants, especially young immigrants who are in immigration court, and there is a right to counsel in that court, but there is no right to the provision of counsel if you can't afford it. And so these youthful immigrants who are technically called unaccompanied, undocumented minors when they are detained with a lapsed visa or because they came into the country without documents in the first place, they face this immigration system, which is actually not part of the court system but is adjudicative. It's part of the Justice Department. They face it now with the right to have a lawyer, but if they are too poor to get one, and obviously a young immigrant is the least likely to be able to afford one, they don't necessarily get to have one. And there are organizations that we profile in this piece that do try to provide pro bono help, but obviously they can't keep up with the volume. And there is a movement now to try to change that, to try to provide, you know, some counsel to people. You know, I spend a lot of time in city courtrooms. I see people who, you know, enjoy this wonderful right to counsel, you know, for jumping the turnstiles ticket. It's kind of crazy that you can have a lawyer to, you know, prevent you from having to serve a day or two in jail or pay a small fine for jumping the turnstile, which is great. But not if you're facing deportation from this country to, you know, someplace you may not even remember. So that's a really interesting topic that you can read on our site, and I think that's going to be an emerging part of the immigration debate, basically for as long as we avoid doing anything comprehensive about immigration and when the courts are still sort of charged with, you know, wading through that issue on a case-by-case basis.
Great. So what else you got for us?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, my son's got a Little League game today. You know, it's Father's Day. I could talk about life as a father. How much more time do we have?
Oh, we have about 2 minutes. I understand you were interested in what's going on with Congressman Weiner and how he's going to impact on politics here in New York City.
Right. Well, obviously, we're more than 2 years from the next mayoral election, but one of the, you know, sub-chapters of the Anthony Weiner saga is that, you know, the person who was our probably the odds-on favorite to be the favorite in the mayoral race. He had the most money. He, you know, ran in 2005 and had a pretty strong showing. You know, he was the guy who, sort of the guy to beat. It is likely, you know, you can't say for sure, but it is very likely that he will not be in the race. And so that really changes not only the cast of characters, but, you know, raises the question of what will this race be about? And it might seem premature to ask that question, but all the people who are now going to be the main players, you know, Speaker of the Council, Christine Quinn, the Comptroller, John Liu, the Public Advocate, Bill de Blasio, the Manhattan Borough President, Scott Stringer, they're all active in politics, and they are, if they are considering that race, their actions over the next couple of years are going to be geared towards setting themselves up for that run. So,
are they all canceling their Twitter accounts?
That's a very good question, yeah. Either that or at least they're throwing out the digital camera, one or the other. But so that's something to keep an eye on and you know, wonder about what this race will be about. The past couple have been referendums on Mike Bloomberg. The next one, you know, might be to some extent, especially because Christine Quinn has always been perceived as being very close to him, and she probably is the best positioned now to make a citywide race because as Speaker you get to hand out a lot of cookies and she has a lot of money and she's very smart.
Well, let's ask a question about Quinn. I mean, to what extent, I mean, obviously there's a lot of people upset right now in New York City. Every time you walk by City Hall, it's one demonstration after the other, massive demonstrations by the unions. You know, to what extent does her political future require her to actually do a budget that just doesn't pretty much, you know, reaffirm the parameters set out by, you know, the present mayor, you know, besides, you know, putting back some of the cuts that, you know, is just sort of a game that they play?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Her relationship with the unions, as you hit on, is kind of fascinating. And, you know, for her to run a serious campaign, the argument could be made that she has to fight back harder on the cuts. But, you know, because she needs the union support. But the fact is, if you look at some of the other candidates in the race, you know, union support especially getting all of it, might be kind of off the table for her. You know, she has fairly good treatment by the tabloids. She can, you know, kind of run in the same vein as Mike Bloomberg did in terms of tapping into that sort of support. So, you know, on the budget, she has picked her fight. She's fought the mayor on the Capitol budget, and she's resisted the mayor on some of the specific cuts he's made. Overall, she has said that the budget does need to be cut. She has not bought the argument that some have made, that there is a fund that we can tap into in terms of what's planned to be rolled over for the next fiscal year to close that gap. So she's, you know, playing her cards very closely to her vest. I think the biggest issue is not really the budget, but the living wage bill, which she has yet to say whether she will allow that to come up for a vote. That's obviously a huge priority, at least to the service unions, maybe not so much the building trades, because their interests might be at cross purposes there. But that's probably the key issue. The budget will go, and it'll be next year and a year after that for her to firm up her position on that. But living wage is probably the huge issue where people will be tested looking toward the future.
Jared, well, thank you very much for joining us here today. We got to move on to our next guest. And City Limits website, if you want to see that film you guys put together, the video?
If you want to see the story, it's www.citylimits.org.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you very much. And we're going to be back in just a moment talking to the Director of Policy and Advocacy at United Neighborhood Houses on the New York City budget. We're going to do a quick piece from Planet Woman on population issues.
The catastrophic air attack on Pearl Harbor catapulted the unprepared United States into World War II. Now, an unprepared world is facing other catastrophic changes, such as severe environmental and economic distress. This is Judy Lubow for Planet Warning. According to the United Nations' latest estimate of projected population growth, world population could reach 10.1 billion people by the end of this century. That can't be good news. Already, 1 in 7 people around the world do not have enough food to eat. It's not as if the ways to control human population growth are unknown. Increasing the economic and social status of women consistently results in lower birth rates. And studies have shown that well-designed programs to make family planning information and services available are the most cost-effective way to lower birth rates. But what are we actually doing in the face of this population explosion? According to the New York Times, the U.S. is the biggest donor of international family planning aid. But in the budget compromise reached by Congress in April, international family planning programs were cut by 5%. If you'd like to learn more...
We're back with City Watch and our next guest, Anthony Ng, Director of Policy and Advocacy with United Neighborhood Houses. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning.
So, Anthony, we know this has been a particularly rough budget year at the state level. Now here at the city, this is the 10th round of pay cuts or cuts to programs over the past several years.
Yep.
So,
mm-hmm.
Before we get into the details of the city budget, can you give us a little bit of background in terms of the budget process, where we're at, and how things look?
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me on the show, Brooke.
No, we're so excited to have you.
Yeah. So we're really at the 11th hour here. The city's budget begins every year on July 1, and the city has to pass a balanced budget by that time. So we're really down to the wire. What we're hearing from being down at City Hall and talking to members and just gathering intelligence is that, you know, it's about a week, maybe a week off. There are rumors that there'll be a handshake next week. You never know. You never know how these things may go. They change by the minute in terms of developments. But we're really down to the wire. So, you know, we've been very busy this budget season on the city level, advocating to members, holding rallies, press conferences, and events to build support for our issues, and really working more than ever before, it feels like. But we are down to the wire, and our ability to influence the mayor and the council is really coming down to that. So we remain hopeful, but there's a lot of big gaps in the budget to fill.
So, Anthony, I'd love to dig a little deeper on exactly that, the gaps in the budget. You know, I've been going to some of the budget hearings myself, and it seems like certain populations, really vulnerable, and it's children, youth, the elderly, immigrants, are being hit really, really hard, particularly hard. What are some of the major cuts impacting these groups?
I mean, you're exactly right there, and that's where we're most concerned about. You know, one of the biggest cuts that the mayor put forward in his budget proposals this year was a cut to early childhood education subsidies.
It's one of the biggest in history.
Biggest in history. And he had first identified this back in January in his preliminary budget, but really identified it through a bullet point in one of his presentations, a footnote. And this cut would have eliminated for 16,500 children in New York City their child care subsidies. Now, the mayor in his executive budget put some money back to give those children and families an option, not a guarantee, an option for care for next year. But our concern remains this. I mean, they only put $40 million back. The hole we were looking at was $91 million. So there's still...
That's not even half.
Not even half. So there's still $51 million. And then there's still some money that the city council restored last year that was only for 1 year for 119 classrooms, early childhood classrooms. So if you add this all up, you know, in terms of what we still need from the 91, the money that the council put back that the mayor didn't include in his preliminary budget proposal, you know, we're looking at potentially 7,000 slots in early childhood education classrooms and family child care programs that will not be there moving forward, beginning July 1, if money's not put back in the budget. You know, we're very concerned about the capacity of the city's child care system moving forward if funding isn't put back to bolster that. So that's one big concern we have. Young people, youth after-school programs, OST programs, beacons, programs for runaway homeless youth, summer jobs, you know, we're looking at about, you know, $60 million there.
That's being lost.
That's on the chopping block right now. And that's up to 50,000 young people, 50,000 fewer young people will have these programs next year if we don't restore this money.
I mean, and the programs that you just named, including the programs for runaway and homeless youth, I mean, Beacons, OST, Summer Youth Employment Programs, this is what young people do when they're not in school. They go to after-school programs and they work.
Yeah.
And you're talking about major cuts to those core programs.
Yes. I mean, it's said so often, but it's so true. Children and youth are our future, and we need to make sure that they have programs and resources that continue to allow them to grow and develop even after the school hours, after 3 p.m., on holidays and on weekends. You know, you want to keep young people engaged and learning. So if we're cutting out, you know, over $60 million of the city budget that supports these programs, there's going to be fewer opportunities for young people. You know, they're going to have less engaging things to do. Some may just idle with their time. Some, unfortunately, may get into some bad activities.
Right.
So, you know, we really need to think about our future here. And I think it's very clear that if you invest money in these programs, there will be a payoff. So the city has to think about this.
You know, Anthony, I think listening to the extent of these cuts, a very frustrating part of this is that the Mayor Bloomberg's budget appears to not realize that we are barely recovering from the Great Recession. You know, we have unemployment amongst the young adults that's just humongous.
Again,
in the
historic.
City. Historically high unemployment for these disconnected youth.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading Crane's Business the other day, and they said in there that it's, you know, fact that if a youth who's disconnected from employment, every year they lose major earning potential, because basically every year that, you know, you're not working and building your career, then an employer is going to look at you when you're, you know, 22 or something versus when you're 18 and say, well, what have you been doing these last couple of years? So we're talking about young people who deserve a chance to get employment and training and education and programs. And it's going to be a lost generation. And in the mayor's budget, doesn't seem to look at that at all, and certainly in terms of looking at, you know, what are some solutions in terms of revenue. So tell us what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I mean, one of the city's key programs to help with youth employment is the Summer Youth Employment Program. Now, there have been state and federal cuts over the years. We don't have any more stimulus money. You know, a few years ago, the mayor made some cuts to the summer jobs program himself, but was able to plug those holes with some stimulus money. You know, we don't have stimulus money anymore. The state money for summer jobs has been cut the past 2 years in a row. Mm-hmm. We got the same amount this year as last year, but last year was the first year that they had cut it from $35 million, which we had for a few years. We only got $15.5 million in the state budget last year and this year. You know, it is a little baffling that we don't have more of a response, especially for young people, because you're right. Researchers do show that the earlier you have work experience, the better you are down the road. And, you know, I read articles all the time now about, for even college graduates, how difficult it is for them to find a job. So we're talking about some young people who may have stopped school for whatever reason, or trying to come back and get their GED. Young people, even who aren't at that stage, who are in school, but, you know, between 14 and 18, they're on the path to do the right thing. They want to work during the summertime. Where are the opportunities for them? So I do think we need to think about how to provide more opportunities and job opportunities for young people moving forward. And, you know, that's a big thing that we'd love to work more with the mayor and the governor on. I mean, the mayor has been raising some private dollars for the summer jobs program this year. So that's a welcome addition. You know, we just urge that moving forward, all public money is maximized, and that the city and the state and the feds can maximize their investment in the summer youth employment program.
Yeah, but I think one thing, by the way, with the private dollars, which, you know, the mayor, that has been something that the mayor has turned to, is trying to raise private foundation dollars. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge with that is usually what happens is the foundations take money away from one deserving group to fund another one. So these foundations that are now perhaps funding summer youth employment, which is a good thing, are usually taking money away from something else they were funding, like, you know, child welfare programs or, you know, child care programs.
I also think there's sort of a deeper fundamental problem with this. I mean, I'm as much of a fan of public-private sort of bonding and collaboration around entrenched social problems as the next person. But, you know, part of what I struggle with, Anthony, about what you're saying around children and youth is that I think there's a responsibility that government has to children, to young people, to people in poverty. And, you know, maybe I'm a raging leftist, but I think that that's part of the sort of basic social contract. And what's very upsetting to me is, and Bikha, you mentioned this, I don't think that the mayor, and I thought this with the governor's budget as well, I don't think we're exploring revenue options. I think, you know, somehow the narrative has been framed in terms of cuts, 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 and it's, you know, do we cut from kids or do we cut from the elderly? And not really exploring how can we grow the pie. So,
yeah. I do want to just also say a little bit about aging services as well.
1 minute.
1 minute. Well, real quick, you know, on aging services, you know, we're facing, you know, $41 million in cuts, and this funding is going to programs, a lot of funding that goes into what senior centers do, case management, geriatric mental health, elder abuse programs. I mean, there's a whole bunch of aging programs that are on the chopping block as well. The Department for the Aging, the funding that they allocate to programs has been cut so deeply these past few years. We've lost $50 million since 2008. So we have to hold the line on there. We can't cut another dollar from aging services. And on revenue, we agree. That's why we at UNH, we are supportive of calling on the state to extend the personal income tax surcharge for high-income earners. And, you know, we also would agree with the look to take more money out of the health care trust fund, the city's quote-unquote rainy day fund, to support some of these programs and services. Mm-hmm. So we agree. Revenue has to be looked at as well.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, Anthony, we're going to wrap up. Thank you so much. As always, I love having you on the show.
Thank you. I'm glad we figured it out.
I know, and we'll definitely get you back. As we finish up, why don't you tell us very quickly, where can people go online to learn how to get more involved?
Oh, well, there's many places to go. United Neighborhood Houses, we have a Facebook page, so you can go to our Facebook page and see what we've been up to in terms of rallies and everything. On the childcare issue, there's a Save Childcare website.
And then I guess the Neighborhood Family Services Coalition.
Yeah, and then our colleagues, Neighborhood Family Services Coalition, we work closely with, they have they have some information as well. There's also a Save After School blog website managed by the Education Alliance. So if you look that up.
Okay.
But, you know, I would tell your listeners in these final days, call the mayor. If you care about programs, call the mayor, call 311, call your council member. You know, we're getting down to the wire, but it's important that people weigh in.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Have a great
week. Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
And we're going to take a quick musical interlude, and then we'll be back talking with Tim Casey, senior staff attorney with Legal Momentum, about their work in advancing the rights of women and girls, and with a little Last to Die by Bruce Springsteen.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day.
We're back with City Watch, and we're now joined by Tim Casey, senior staff attorney with Legal Momentum. Legal Momentum is the nation's oldest legal advocacy organization dedicated to advancing the rights of women and girls, and we're very excited to have Tim, who is a longtime advocate on anti-poverty issues, with us in the studio. Tim,
good morning. Thank
you. Good morning. Yeah. You guys, released a report recently about single mothers and poverty. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The focus of this recent report was comparing poverty rates for single mothers in the United States with poverty rates for single mothers in other high-income countries. And what our study found was that the poverty rate for single mothers in the United States was the highest among the 15 high-income countries that we looked at, almost twice the average. And the higher poverty rates in this country for single mothers is illustrative of an overall higher poverty rate in the United States for almost all groups than in other high-income countries, and a much higher poverty rate in this country for women than for men. There's been a large gender poverty gap in every year since poverty measurement began in the 1960s.
So despite being one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest country in the world, we're one of the poor. There's a much higher percentage of people who are poor in our country, especially single mothers.
Yes. We don't, compared to other high-income countries, we do less to provide child care to allow single mothers to work. Our wages at the bottom of the wage scale are lower than they are in most other high-income countries. Our social assistance system, our welfare programs, our unemployment compensation programs for those who are jobless, much stingier than other high-income countries. So the consequence is just much higher poverty rates for single mothers.
And a bigger gap, I would imagine,
yes,
between rich and poor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, our previous guest talked about the city budget cuts and that, you know, the situation's already so bleak in terms of the lack of those supports that you've just mentioned, and now we're talking about a city budget that's going to cut further to early childhood education and cut further to supports for low-income working people.
Yeah, it's sort of a vicious cycle. Single mothers already have a jobless rate of between 30 and 35%. And in part, that's because jobs aren't available, but in part, it's because child care is not available. So if you cut child care, you put more people, as a practical matter, out of work. You make it impossible for them to work. and then when they turn to the welfare system for assistance, and they knock on the door, they can't get in because the welfare system has so many obstacles to getting in, to getting aid when you're needy. And if they do get in the door, the benefits they get are far below the official poverty level. So the situation's already very bleak and very bad.
It's like quicksand.
Yes, and seems to be getting worse at both the national, state, and city levels.
Mm-hmm. Jim, let's talk a little bit about the federal poverty level you just mentioned. It's such a ridiculous level, and it's about $18,000 a year for a family of three.
Yes.
And then you've just said that the average welfare grant is actually way below that level. So how is it that we ended up in this country with this kind of welfare program?
Well, the welfare system in this country has always been relatively stingy compared to the welfare systems in other high-income countries. So things have never been really great, but things were much better prior to the welfare reforms in the mid-1990s, the federal welfare reforms, than they are today. Prior to the so-called welfare reform, 3 out of 5 poor children in this country received welfare assistance when they were in need. Today that's down to 1 out of 5 children. Welfare benefits were below the poverty level in almost all states prior to welfare reform, but now in most states they're below less than half of the poverty level. In a majority of states, the per capita benefit for a family of three in the welfare system is less than $5 a person a day.
Good.
We should mention that you are listening to City Watch, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org on the web. This is Mark Dunley with co-hosts Bikaf Pham and Brooke Ritchie, and we're talking with Tim Casey, Senior Staff Attorney with Legal Momentum. Now, wasn't TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family, the federal welfare program, up for reauthorization this year? It seems like it's fallen off the table. And are there things you're trying to get changed with that reauthorization?
Sure. Well, a lot of our work in recent years has been trying to focus the attention of the public and on policymakers in the deep flaws in the TANF program as a result of federal welfare reform, with the hope that that would lead federal policymakers to redesign the TANF program to make the program more accessible and benefits more adequate. The program will, in theory, expire September 30th of this year if it's not reauthorized or extended. At this time, it's hard to say whether Congress will do a full reauthorization, whether they'll look at making significant changes, or whether they'll do just a 1 or 2 year extension, sort of as is extension. But the context now of the debate has shifted, as you know, as dramatically as a result of the last election. So now, as a practical matter, we're looking at large proposed cuts, not only throughout the social welfare, federal social welfare system, cuts in food stamps, cuts in unemployment, cuts in WIC, cuts in Medicaid, and perhaps cuts in TANF. So at this point in time, the prospects are that the social welfare system, which is already terribly inadequate, may become even less adequate.
You know, and for this Great Recession, I think, has introduced, unfortunately, led new people to the doors of the wolves, try to seek assistance from the welfare agencies, you know, the new poor. And I know personally, as well as through colleagues, of, you know, neighbors and friends who've tried to actually apply for the first time for public assistance or food stamps in the city, and they're just they're shocked at the treatment they get at these centers in terms of the you know, long lines, the rude treatment, the you have to do this and do that and do this to get your, you know, $20 a month for food. And so I'm wondering, given that, you know, I think people are thinking more and more today of realizing they're going to one day, if not very, very soon, have to rely on these government programs. So when are we going, Tim, what do you think in terms of when are we going to shift to, you know, the public basically demanding that these programs be shored up because it's for their own self-interest?
I wish I knew the answer. You know, some people argue that public policy turns to the better when more and more people become poor. Certainly, we do have more people becoming poor today, so hopefully that will lead to a demand for a more adequate social assistance system. But at the moment, the policy debates in Washington are focused on cutting spending rather than addressing the real holes in the safety net.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, I mean, the recent report and the work that your organization focuses on, women
yes.
in poverty, and looking at some of what you were saying about single mothers in poverty, I wonder if some of that shift, Bikha, that we're all hoping for might come as people focus on the sort of intergenerational implications of what's happening. You know, so not providing childcare for a working mom doesn't just mean that she loses her job and there's that sort of immediate economic mm-hmm. consequence. There's also an economic and educational consequence for her children. And, you know, as social science shows, so many of children in poverty who grow up in very impoverished single-parent households stay poor. About 46% stay poor their whole lives. A number of them become single mothers themselves. So I wonder if focusing on that, what are your thoughts on this sort of intergenerational argument?
Well, you know, our recent report focused on the higher poverty rates of single mothers, but of course, the United States has much higher poverty rates for children than most other high-income countries, over 20% by the official poverty standard. And you know, one argument, of course, for why we should do something about this, an argument based on human rights and social justice.
Absolutely.
But the other argument is the one you mentioned. There have been numerous studies showing that poverty during childhood has severe consequences for a large number of children who grow up poor when they're adults. Higher unemployment rates, higher incarceration rates, higher rates of being sick and disabled. So we can argue for investment in children when they're young, and there's a real payback when they become adults.
Tim, one of the things that your organization looks at is economic security for low-income women and girls. And welfare policy has not been an anti-poverty policy. It hasn't been an economic security policy in this city and state in the sense that they generally don't care whether or not you're going to be able to make ends meet in terms of a living wage job. I mean, one of the ways they don't care is because they discourage access to education training, like vocational training, and in this state. And what happens when you have a poor single mother and she's not getting the education and skills training she needs to get actually a living wage job?
Well, typically that means then a long period of years of deep, severe poverty. One of the irrationalities in our current welfare policy is that in every other context in this country, we think of education as a public good. If people educate themselves, we think that is making us all better off. But in welfare policy, that notion that education is a public good disappears, and our current welfare policy actually discourages single mothers from going to school, from improving themselves and obtaining the skills they need to get jobs that pay a living wage.
Which really is then becomes this huge inefficient system, because that single mom is not going to make it on $8 an hour working at Duane Reade and has a very difficult time paying her rent, comes back on the welfare rolls after a certain number of months, and we're repeating the cycle over and over again.
Yes.
And in the meanwhile, by the way, taxpayers, it's your taxpayers that are going to feed the welfare agencies doing this churning. So it's just a system that is frustrating, doesn't help a lot of people, and hopefully will be changed around by legal momentum during the federal advocacy.
I hope so.
So, Tim, I guess we unfortunately are running out of time with just about a minute left. Is there anything else you want? You know, is there a webpage that you guys have?
Yeah, legalmomentum.org, and your listeners can go to our webpage and get more information about welfare policy in this country and what they can do about it. But it's important for all listeners now to be involved in the debates now going on at the city, state, and federal levels about what directions policy in this country is going to take over the next years in addressing our current major economic problems.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
And we're going to come right back with Patrick Markey of the Coalition for the Homeless. Meanwhile, we're going to do a little bit old tape with Che Guevara here at WBAI.
1949, Pacifica Radio went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America. Che Guevara was a political theorist, revolutionary strategist, military comandante, and hero of the Cuban Revolution. On December 16, 1964, he met with a group of socialist journalists at the Cuban Mission in New York City and gave an informal press conference. Pacifica's Chris Koch was there. Che Guevara from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Comandante Guevara was dressed in pressed military fatigues and polished black boots. During the conversation, he was in constant motion, lying on his side, shifting to a squatting position, back to his side, resting his head on his hands, and puffing constantly on a cigar. Constant motion. Guevara was relaxed, joked much, smiled always.
Los revolucionarios no son gente normal.
The revolutionary people are not normal people.
Eso se lo puedo asegurar.
That I can assure you.
Pero, en definitiva,
but
lo importante es que la capacidad de construcción y de sacrificio.
But in the long run, the important thing is that the capacity for sacrifice and construction
se va desarrollando.
Be developed.
El revolucionario hace la revolución.
The revolutionary makes the revolution.
Pero la revolución hace el revolucionario.
But the revolution makes the revolutionary.
Y es una interrelación constante.
And there is an interrelationship, a constant interrelationship.
Donde el revolucionario va alcanzando grados más altos.
Where the revolutionary achieves a higher level of conscience.
Che Guevara from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
So welcome back, everyone. We are here on City Watch. This is Brooke Ritchie, joined by co-hosts Bikha Pham and Mark Dunley. And we are really excited to have Patrick Markey from the Coalition of the Homeless joining us by phone. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the program.
Great. So your organization just released its State of the Homeless report, its State of the Homeless 2011 report. What did the report find? What are some of the overall findings?
Well, this is an annual report we do that attempts to look at the trends in homelessness in New York City and then to focus on major public policy issues involving homelessness in the city. And the bad news from this year's report is that homelessness in New York City has reached the worst levels since the Great Depression of the 1930s. You know, this is, according to city data, more New Yorkers experienced homelessness last year and ever since the city's been keeping records. More than 113,000 different men, women, and children used the city's shelter system last year. That includes nearly 43,000 children. Those are all-time record levels. And the numbers of homeless families who used the city shelter system last year, also at the highest levels, was 80% higher than when Mayor Bloomberg took office. At the same time, the single night kind of count of how many homeless New Yorkers are using our shelter system, which is now 39,000, also reached all-time records, record levels earlier this year. So we're facing literally a historic crisis of homelessness. Now, the reasons for that, you know, continue to be fundamentally about the housing affordability crisis in the city. Rents continue to be out of reach for far too many low-income New Yorkers. Wages are just not high enough for working poor families to afford apartment rents, even in some of the lower-income neighborhoods in the city. But one of the major causes also is the failures of the Bloomberg administration's approach to the problem of homelessness, and so we took a very close look at that as well in the report.
So tell us more about that. I mean, are you referring to the Bloomberg administration's time-limited subsidy programs?
Absolutely. You know, it's important to sort of, you know, again, take a step back and look at how the city has approached the problem of homelessness, particularly family homelessness, over the last 20 years. And various mayors, you know, from Koch through Giuliani, recognized that there needed to be some form of housing assistance to help homeless families move from shelters back into the community. Rents are too high for these families. They're going to need some form of rental assistance, some form of housing subsidy to make the transition from the shelter system back into housing in the community. Now, the primary tool that the city used, again, under previous mayors, was our federal housing programs. New York City has a scarce supply of public housing and Section 8 vouchers. These are federal rental vouchers that are available each year. And what the city used to do was to allocate roughly a third of available public housing apartments or federal rental vouchers to help families make the transition from shelter into the community. Now, the reason that the city did that was for a couple of reasons. One, it's very successful. The families that made the move from shelters into public housing or into Section 8 vouchers were extraordinarily successful in keeping their housing and staying in the community. They have very, very low rates of return to homelessness. And the second reason is that because those programs are paid for largely by federal dollars and the city shelter system is very expensive and is paid for by city and state tax dollars largely, it was very smart fiscal policy as well to utilize those federal programs. Keep in mind that it costs $36,000 a year to shelter a family in the city shelter system. That's an extraordinary amount of money, so it made sense to do something to help these families with federal housing assistance.
So, Patrick, it sounds like this, you know, the use of federal housing programs to help the homeless transition to you know, more secure and affordable housing made a lot of sense. So what did the Bloomberg administration do differently in terms of moving to this time-limited program?
Well, again, one of the major, major failure of Mayor Bloomberg's approach to homelessness was that back in 2004, 2005, he acted to cut off homeless New Yorkers from access to federal housing programs. He broke again with nearly 20 years of successful city housing policy, homeless policy, and essentially cut off homeless families from that priority access that they had to certain numbers of public housing units and Section 8 vouchers. What he did was he replaced those federal housing programs with a series of time-limited rent subsidy programs that had very, very strict, stringent requirements, programs that would give you, as the most recent of these programs did, the Advantage program, would provide a family with only one or a maximum of 2 years of rental assistance and then cut them off, even if they were too poor to continue to afford apartment rents. And what we began to see, as many of us predicted, was essentially a revolving door back into shelter for thousands and thousands of homeless families and children. The city's own data bore this out. We began to see, again, under this Advantage program, which was launched in 2007, we've seen more than a third of all of the families who are in that program who've been cut off of rental assistance, who lost their rental assistance under the time limits. We've seen more than a third of those families already come back to apply for shelter. We've seen the percentage of families coming into shelter who are formerly homeless climb from 1 in 4 back under the system where the city used federal housing programs to now half. So literally half of all families coming into our shelter system are families who were in the shelter system just a few years ago. And that's a result, really, of these failed time-limited programs.
You know, and it doesn't seem to make any sense in terms of the planning here. You know, we live in, unfortunately, in a city and in a society where once you're in a low-wage job, you most likely are not going to go anywhere because these low-wage jobs are just, you know, getting more and more available. Those are almost the only jobs available. And if you're not going to get the training or education, you know, skills to move you up the career ladder, you're stuck there. And that's what the data finds, is that most people who are in low-wage job unfortunately stay there. And so when you're planning a, you know, time-limited subsidy program, where do you think these individuals are going to go, especially when, you know, programs like the welfare agency completely discourage or prohibit you from attending education training?
Well, it also doesn't, I'm sorry, I was going to say, it also doesn't make sense just from a pure accountability standpoint. I mean, what kind of program are we, if you're running a nonprofit and you ask for money to run a program where the outcomes are 50% of the people, more than 50% of the people
are going to be back in
fail, don't accomplish the outcomes that you're getting the money for, that program would be shut down.
Mm-hmm. Well, this really speaks to, I have to say, Bikal, you make an excellent point that this is an example where the data, the evidence, the real-world experience of these families completely flies in the face of the ideological sort of structure behind these policies. Bloomberg administration officials, you know, constantly, most recent in a series of budget hearings, keep saying, well, we're just going to count on families who are homeless to work, and that's how they're going to get out of shelter and all of that. And it's the kind of thing, it's just soundbite, sort of PR policy aimed at the editorial page of the New York Post, you know, aimed at the tabloids.
It's specious. It really sounds good, but it doesn't mean anything.
Sounds good, but doesn't really mean anything because, and then again, this came out in some of the questioning at the hearing, the Department of Homeless Services' own data shows that these families who are working, who are by the city's lights doing what they should be doing, simply are not earning enough to afford apartment rents. The city's data found that families, even the families that were in the Advantage program, this program where you had to be working in order to get a subsidy, were earning $9 an hour on average, working 32 hours a week. So they were earning, you know, roughly $1,100 a month. And their apartment rents were averaging $1,000 or $1,100 a month. It's simply a math problem at that point. These families are not earning enough to pay the rent. And, you know, you can sort of spout all the ideology and, you know, talk all the talk you want about, you know, they're promoting work and promoting self-sufficiency. But at the end of the day, the labor market is what it is in New York City. The housing market is what it is. And these families simply are not earning enough. In contrast, the wealth of research and evidence from the 20 years when the city used federal housing programs found that the families that moved into housing through those programs stayed in housing, stayed in the community. There's a wealth of research and evidence that shows that families who get housing assistance, particularly Section 8 vouchers, are much more successful in making a transition from welfare to work. Their families are much more stable. All of those good outcomes that come from using stable housing assistance. And so this is an example, again, of the Bloomberg administration, you know, which constantly gets portrayed in the news media as basing their policies on data and evidence and fact and research. They're absolutely ignoring the evidence and research and facts when it comes to homeless policy.
Well, Patrick, we have about 3 minutes. We have about 3 minutes left. In the state budget, the Advantage program was not funded. I noticed you out there earlier this week out in front of city council building trying to talk to city council members about the city budget. How are you guys faring in the city budget? What are you trying to do, and what can people do in these last week or so around the city budget and homeless issues?
Well, just to quickly just to say a word about Advantage, of course, the state and the city had a policy and budget dispute around the Advantage program, and ultimately the city chose just a couple months ago to eliminate the program. The tragedy is that, as it stands now, the city has no policy in place for moving families out of shelter. There's literally no housing subsidy available. And there are, you know, roughly 13,000 Advantage tenants, families who had already been moved into apartments, who are also threatened with losing their subsidy. Fortunately, our colleagues at the Legal Aid Society in a class action litigation have won an injunction that has required the city to pay rents at least through June. We're hopeful that'll go through the end of the summer, but that litigation continues. In the city budget process, unfortunately, Mayor Bloomberg is also proposing a series of cutbacks to funds for shelters for homeless youth, particularly LGBT youth, shelter contracts for families and individuals, prevention programs, a whole host of other programs, including supportive housing programs for formerly homeless people living with AIDS. And all of these cutbacks, of course, would be really devastating, coming on top of cuts that we saw from the state budget just a couple months ago. So we're out there along with service providers and advocates, really urging the council not to do these cuts, and even more important, to look at revenues, to look at raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers, cutting subsidies to banks, cutting tax breaks to hedge funds, all of the things that would actually raise revenues and share the pain equally.
Well, we have 1 minute left. I want to ask you about the fact that the new Department of Homeless Services commissioner was a former deputy commissioner at the City Welfare Agency, and one of the things he's bringing to the homeless situation in New York is a policy of diversion or making it very difficult for you to actually get homeless services, which I guess is a way to solve the problem in terms of making it harder for people to get assistance. Then you don't have your guests.
And we're back
customers.
In 1984 with people just sleeping on the streets.
Right. So, anyways, Patrick, what are your concerns in terms of the treatment of homeless individuals?
In 30 seconds.
Well, quickly, I'll direct listeners to our website, coalitionforthehomeless.org. We released a report last month about how, as Picot said, homeless families applying for shelter now are getting turned away in larger numbers than ever. And remember, this was at a time of high unemployment. I think it exactly speaks to that Giuliani-era philosophy, that sort of harsh deny people assistance philosophy that came from that era and unfortunately is continuing to this day.
Well, thanks for doing the report, Patrick, and all the good work you guys do, and we appreciate you joining us.
Great. Thanks so much.
So you have been listening to City Watch and co-host Brooke Ritchie, Vic Hoffbaum, and Mark Dunley. We'd like to thank Mark Dunley for engineering, and the MP3 download of this week's show will be available on www.wbai.org. Go to archives and look for City Watch. The show will be available 10 minutes after showtime and will remain available for the next 7 days.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
We want to extend a very big thank you to the following restaurants for keeping our volunteers happy and well-fed during this WBAI May 2011 fund drive. Arturo's at 106 West Houston Street near Thompson, Da Michele at 275 Church Street, the East Harlem Cafe at 1651 Lexington Avenue, Bry's South African Cuisine at 329 West 51st Street, Casa Adela at 66 Avenue C, Stella at 213 Front Street. When you stop into these great restaurants for a bite with your friends, don't forget to let the managers know we are grateful for the way they kept this WBAI Spring Fun Drive happy. Thank you very much to you all.
The Clearwater Festival in Westchester joins you in supporting WBAI. This year's festival is on June 18 and 19 and features hundreds of artists, including Pete Seeger, The Indigo Girls, Martin Sexton, Josh Ritter, The Low Anthem, Dar Williams, and many more. Full lineup and tickets at clearwaterfestival.org.
'65 marks the abolition of slavery in the United States of Texas. This holiday is Juneteenth, honoring African American heritage. The Elizabeth Juneteenth Committee presents Juneteenth 2011, a celebration of freedom starting June 17th through June 19th. For more information, contact 908-352-7078. Understand who you are, embrace, and celebrate your African American heritage.
Fukushima on the Hudson. Find out more Thursday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Sunnyside. Speaker Ken Gale, the host and producer of Ecologic on WBAI-FM, will be talking about the Indian Point nuclear power plant on the Hudson River, a few miles north of New York City. Learn about the health effects, especially cancer, of both an accident and daily routine releases of radiation. Learn about the connection between nuclear power and climate change. And there are many other electricity sources that are available now. All Saints Episcopal Church, 43-1246 Street in Sunnyside, Queens. Take the number 7 local to 46th Street, Wood Street, one half block north. Sponsored by SunnysideWoodsidePeace.org, the West Queens Greens, and the Veterans for Peace.
Hey, it's eBay, and the Hip Hop Takeover is coming Saturday, June 25th at midnight. This year, we pay tribute to hip hop's pioneers, legends, and icons. Special guest hosts include Afrika Bambaataa, DJ Tony Tone from the Cold Crush Brothers. Hear interviews from Sha Rock, Uncle Ralph McDaniels, and more. That's midnight Saturday, June 25th, lasting 25 hours. And
join us for the official Hip Hop Takeover After Party, Thursday, June 30th, 6 p.m. to midnight at Kush Lounge, located at 191 Christie Street. It's free before 9, so get there early and be prepared to dance. For more info, you can call 212-209-2941 or visit thehiphoptakeover.com.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of City Watch, the entire show will be on the WBAI.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.